Thanks, Joe. So we've got about 20 minutes for questions to everyone, and I'd just like to ask the panel members, and hopefully Tim's still on the line somewhere, to take a seat up the front so that you can start throwing the difficult questions at them. Tim, thank you. Yes. And there should be roving mics as well. So please, anyone want to kick it off? There's a question down the front.
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much. I have a question for Maria. That's a very interesting subject.
It is.
And I remember in 2008, I worked on a study on the use of binary translation and emulation for different types of digital artistic outputs, and demos were one of them. One of the things that surprised us at the time was that even though the community is or has exhibited very vivid activity, documentation of the individual artifacts was really poor. But we also found two things. First was that trying to run the executable files on our machines normally clashed with our antivirus programs. And the other was that when we tried to emulate the software, so not running it, not preserving it as a video file, but preserving the actual executable, it wouldn't work on most of our emulation platforms, including our virtual machines. So virtualized environments, binary translators would not necessarily render the files. And I was wondering, that was in 2008, and there is a paper and a report out that you can have a look at. But I was wondering, because I left the demo scene since, and I was wondering how much things have changed ever since from your experience working with the material.
Well, there is, of course, this technological issue, like with games and every kind of software, preserving it, especially with the issue that you brought up and the pirate antivirus blocking, because it's an .exe file, and you know, as it was overlapping with the cracking and hacker community, sometimes it's really hard to play it. So I can see that there is a growing amount of, like, the most favorite productions are being rendered and put on YouTube. So I think this is the way for preserving it that we are doing right now. And I think it's probably the only way. However, it's problematic because you are using this real-time experience. So I was more focused on the social issue because it's not even touched, but still at the area you are referring to, we have a lot of problems. That's true. You're welcome.
Question up the back.
Hi, I was just wondering, I'm Ian Welsh, I'm on the Play It Again project, and I was just wondering, do you know what the technical reasons were that they're being blocked by antivirus? Was it the fact that, just having a quick look at it now on the websites and stuff, they seem to do a lot of compression and unpacking at runtime? Is that one of the issues? Or was it code rewriting in memory or stuff like that?
Delve too much into why the antivirus was complaining so badly. Oh, thank you. We didn't really delve into the reasons why the antivirus, because this was not really the main theme of the study. However, what we did find was that different, as you would expect, different makes of antivirus software would complain about different things. What was consistent was that for some of them, particularly for executables created for PC, they would consistently be identified as viruses by a number of antivirus software programs.
Oh, cool. No, that's really interesting. Thanks.
There's a question also down the front, but we'll take one wherever the microphone is.
Thank you. This one's predominantly about the Twitter paper, but if other people have opinions too, that's cool. There's some really interesting methodological ideas and stuff there. I was wondering if you considered, or what your opinions were on the ethical considerations of is everything goes because it's public, or do you ask permission on whose tweets you take, or just general opinions on that? I'd be interested in.
Sure, and I'm sure Tim might have something to add.
Do you want to take that one, Walker?
I'll go ahead and take it for right now, but you can add to it. My gosh, you're huge.
I'm having a little bit of the audio.
Okay.
Is this mic working? No. No. Okay.
Oh. Okay. I'll go ahead and add a little something to that. That did come up quite a bit in our research. We made the decision not to include that within the scope of the paper. I think it's a really tricky issue. I think legally, the terms of service for Twitter allow you to do this, and that's okay, legally. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do. Twitter users don't necessarily have an expectation that these sorts of things are going to be systematically harvested and then available to researchers. So there's always a technical solution of anonymizing the data, but you know, when we look into that, there's a new problem that emerges, which is that it can be mashed up with other data and it suddenly becomes not so anonymous. My own feeling on this is that it would perhaps be most appropriate for the data set to be available to users who are vetted in some sort of way, we have an identification for them, they tell us why they're using it, and so on. But it is a tricky situation, and I'm sure other folks have thoughts on it too.
I've got something I can say about how we treat Twitter archives in Pandora. Obviously not prior to 2008 in the sample I was talking about, but these days we try to harvest the Twitter accounts of politicians in regards to elections, but also we're kind of broadening and trying to do a lot more with Twitter as well. But the way for us that it works with permissions is that the National Library, I think, has done a negotiating with Twitter for a broad permission, but we still have to ask permission of every single account holder. Because the way we archive is not, we just want, say, the archive of Christopher Pine. I'm sorry, South Australia apologises deeply. Well, prominent politicians, we try to get a depth rather than a breadth with Twitter. So we catalogue each account as well. So I guess that's kind of why we have to approach it from that way.
Mm-hmm. There's a question down here from Henry.
Okay, I have a question for all three of you. nothing specific in mind. I'm just hoping to spark something. And that's on the difference between the expression and the various things you've looked at and the code underlying it. So in with tweets, we know there's a record with a lot of metadata and other stuff there that we don't necessarily see, of course, when we see the tweet. With demo, it's a source code. And with the web, it's just the HTML, the markup language, everything that's there. And I just wonder if there are any of you have any stories to share about delving into that code beneath the expression as a resource, as something that you use as documentation, and what that might have revealed to you. And of course, if none of you have done that, that would also be interesting for me to know.
Well, if I can start, because the answer is really simple. Sinners don't let you inside the code. So you can only use the exe file to see it, but the source code is really, you know, preserved for them to develop. So it's not an open source issue.
Well, if I can jump in,
mm-hmm.
The source code still exists somewhere, though. So there's a possibility of archiving that source code or finding the person who did it or locating, and some source code certainly has been
mm-hmm.
been made available. So I'm just curious if you haven't, it's okay too. That's mm-hmm. also an interesting thing to know.
No, I think there is a possibility, but it's not a practice. what's going on?
Weirdness. what I can say with Pandora is that we use a software called HTTrack, and what it does is it changes the HTML to break all of the links and insert references in the coding to pointing to all of the files within the environment of the web, the harvest itself, rather than outside. So what it does is it inserts a time and a date stamp, and we're also able to manipulate that code. So sometimes the automatic the harvesting software, it changes it, but sometimes it redirects the directories and creates new ones. So it's, in one sense, it's not incredibly authentic because it's using entirely different code behind the scenes to create something to look like it. And the other thing that we do is actively manipulate the code. If we upload a YouTube clip, because all external links are broken in our Pandora archive sites, but a lot of YouTube clips add a lot of content. If you've got like a band or just something, a clip where you can tell that from an intellectual property point of view, it definitely belongs to them, but it's not in the harvest and it's really missing something. We have to add in a Shockwave flash file and change the coding in terms of the sizing for the frame and the embed text that we use, so that manipulates that so that we can kind of just cram it in this way.
There is a huge amount of metadata that's typically associated with a tweet. If you've ever seen a full map of all the fields, it, as Tim mentioned, it could include a self identified location that's just a free text field. It could include GIS coordinates. It can even include the Twitter client that was used to make the tweet. So we think, all things being equal, it would be great to have all that information. Who knows what you could, what kind of information you could derive from that, those bits of metadata. My primary frustration with working with Twitter is that even though the API is documented, even though your client may be open source, that core action of getting the tweet is closed, and we don't really have that information about why something was returned, except for it matching some criteria. So I don't know what we can do to hedge against that, but except to document as much as we can on our own end.
If I, okay.
It's like God.
if I could add something, because I just remembered regarding the code and accessibility of the code, there's a new trend because, you know, after the destandardization of the platforms, Demoscene is really trying to find a new way. So the first intro I was showing you was really in the direction of the new media art, you know, so trying to figure out how to develop this subculture. They started last year the new idea for the competition, which is live coding. So you have a limited time, like 20 minutes, to code a demo. And it's like an esport stream that you can see. It's really, really interesting. At the screen, you can actually, at that point, see the code being created. And versus split screen, so one side is the code and the other side is the effect being created. So, just a thought.
I'm going to throw something in here too, which is that it's about the context, of course, but it's also about knowing the developers. And I guess there's an Australian net artist called Mez Breeze, whose work has just been acquired by the Duke University Rare Book section of their library. I don't have the full title. And it went into... She's an Australian net artist and poet, and a lot of the poetry is in the code itself. So without knowing the context, you would never get to what is her creative practice. And it's interesting that
She's been considered an important figure from a UK archive and been pulled in through that stream rather than through an Australian institution. So, you know, and maybe it is not a national collaborative effort, but very much an international collaborative effort, and where our focuses of experience and expertise are. Please, there's other people that must have questions out there. Oh, Melanie.
Just a quick one, to all of you, really. What does local mean these days?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're meant to have a selection policy that tells us this, but really it's just, it can be adapted and it's flexible. For us, we would put the criteria of local being South Australian, but then what if you've got a South Australian overseas? So we look at kind of local content, not so much as local URL or collection or location on the internet. But then you've also got at a state level, like a state sporting team like the Adelaide Crows, but then you can also say local as in like your local government, your very small little micro suburb as well. And I think for a collecting institution like the library, it really does kind of need to be spelt out, and particularly when we're in a national archive like Pandora, which deals with it seems to have, it's a one size fits all. It's national, it's state, and it's local, for want of a better word, at that lower level. But I think local can kind of mean what you kind of want it to, which is possibly not good.
So when I think about local, I think about two methodologies. So one is from the localization theory in translation studies by Anthony Pym. In this theory, locale is constructed by the national market. It's connected with the language, it's connected with legal issues, cultural issues, so it's really complex, but it's more or less national. And on using the other theory, more from the globalization studies, you always have this global issue. So, and I think it particularly well relates to Demosthene, because you have this global fandom, global community, and then you have the local one and they are interacting. So there are no clear boundaries for locale.
Any other questions? There is a question about halfway up. Yes, I'd love Tim to respond since we kept him here and awake. It's probably about midnight.
Can I give a microphone to someone halfway up?
There's a question at the top.
Oh, and there's a question at the top.
I think we'll take those two questions and then head out for lunch.
Interrupt here, but I just want to know about the Pandora, because one of the big things that affects your experience of a site is on the web is like what plugins you have, which version of browser. Can you sort of say, I want to, do you get metadata that tells you this is best viewed in X with this plugin or stuff like that?
We're able to do that at something we call a TP title entry page, which is, it presents the link just before you get into the site, where you can put little notes where you can say, you know, best viewed in IE or whatever. And it's quite an interesting little historical thing, because you can look back at 10 years of a website and you can see best viewed in blah, blah, plugin version 1, version 2, version 3. It gets quite an interesting little chronology of the software. But you can also put in notes like that. A lot of things don't work in an archive website, like the big one is streaming. So you've got Google Maps and you've got a great big square hole in the middle of the homepage half the time. And that's not, people aren't too happy when they see their website looking like that. So you can put notes to kind of warn people what may or may not work.
Can I just ask, Walker, did you not have to go through an ethics clearance process at your university to do this research, or?
Tim?
I can actually answer that question. So we actually didn't do the collection ourselves. So as I mentioned, Well, there are two considerations here. One is that the actual collection was done through the Harvard Web Ecology Project. So I don't know what kind of clearance that they had to go through. I did have to go through clearance through my university in order to do content analysis, and I also did qualitative research interviews with people who were involved with the revolution, so I did have to go through an IRB process in order to conduct that segment of my research. But in order to collect tweets, I'm not sure that they had to do anything. I'm not sure that anyone had to do anything in order to, go through any sort of clearance process in order to collect those. I mean, keep in mind, you know, that the Library of Congress in the United States is in the process right now of collecting every single public tweet that has ever been published. So that is all going to be publicly available at some point.
Thank you. I mean, it's a fascinating area, you know, decontextualizing the text from the human being and so on. And yeah, it's very interesting.
Right.
It kind of remains to be seen what the access model will be for the Library of Congress. It is a tricky situation. So we don't know. For the time being, it's only special. Cleared researchers who have access to that resource for now, anyways. Yeah.
Great. I'm going to steal the microphone away and say thank you for that point, because I think that is very important, given a lot of institutions are having to deal with legislation around electronic publications if it's not already in place. So that brings us to lunchtime, and thank you everyone, including Tim. Thank you for staying up and presenting online. But thank you to Maria, Joe, Walker and Tim for this session, and please continue to ask them questions over lunch. Okay.